It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. New York State now has more confirmed coronavirus cases than Italy. Wisconsin's deaths hover around 100. We're spending the hour with an international leader in infectious disease epidemiology. How are you trying to keep yourself safe during the pandemic? Are you wearing a mask and gloves? Do you work for a business that is essential? What is your daily routine like? What do you want to know about the coronavirus, how it may look weeks and months from now? Share your questions. Phone lines are open at 800-642-1234. Dr. Michael Osterholm is a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Osterholm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So many states have imposed lockdown measures, have issued safer at home or safe at home, restricting gathering. But it's a real patchwork out there. Some cities and counties are imposing their own rules. What kind of effect does that have on the pandemic's impact across the U.S.?
Well, first of all, you have to kind of take a step back and look at what it is we're talking about when we talk about a pandemic caused by a coronavirus. It is one very similar to what we'd expect to see with influenza. And I think that people have misunderstood the notion that this is just going to be a short-lived kind of event, if we can just quote-unquote flatten the curve. And in fact, influenza pandemics in the past have often lasted for two or more years. And we think that this coronavirus is going to do the same thing. So one of the challenges we have right now is we've pretty much taken our population and basically conditioned them on just if you can just hold on for a couple more weeks, we're going to basically bend this curve or flatten it by not having more cases by doing this distancing kind of activity. And that surely has been variable already, because in some areas of the country where there's been limited transmission, people don't feel like it's needed. Other areas, of course, that we see every night on the television or talk about on the radio is, in fact, literally on fire, places like New York City. And so the public's been confused about that, and they're also confused about this long-term issue. I mean, you really expect me not to leave my home for the next 18 months? And so one of the things we need to do is have a very frank discussion about what does this pandemic really mean, and what are the means that we can use to actually minimize its impact, but also continue to live our lives over the next 18 months or more.
So in the absence of a vaccine, how do we start to establish herd immunity? What directions can we move there?
Well, first of all, herd immunity, just for all the listeners, to be sure that we're all on the same page, means that enough people are immune to this virus, either through vaccination or through natural infection, recover, and then have this kind of ongoing protection occur. Really, it's unknown what we're going to need to accomplish here in this population to achieve that, where the virus stops transmitting because of so many people being immune. Some of us believe it probably is north of 70% of the population will have to be infected or vaccinated. And so we're not going to get there from vaccination at least through the next 18 to 24 months before we can potentially have a vaccine available. So during the next 24 months, what do we do? And one of the things that we recognize is also that there are people who are very much higher at risk in terms of having a bad disease outcome, meaning getting sick, requiring hospitalization, even spending time in the intensive care ward. And then about 1% of the population will die. And that's a very large number when you start looking at, you know, 320 million Americans, of which half even get infected. That's about 1.6 million people over the course of the next 16 to 18 months. And so what we need to do basically is figure out how to, what I call, thread the rope through the needle, so that we basically release into the public everyday life more of the younger population, those not at nearly as high at risk of having adverse outcomes. And mind you that there will be people who will be hospitalized or maybe even some deaths in those under age 30, 40, but they'll be very, very rare relative to the older population. And that's what we need to have that discussion right now. How do we bring those people back into society more while trying to bubble or basically protect those who are older? A good example is right here in our own state of Minnesota. We now have over 40 outbreaks of this in long-term care facilities. That is a major problem we have right now. So I think what we're trying to do is craft a message that isn't getting crafted very well because we're just lacking at the national level in leadership to actually frame this long-term need as opposed to just covering everything from day-to-day press conferences.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Osterholm, a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. He's at the University of Minnesota. You can join in. How do you think the federal government should act right now as COVID-19 spreads across the state and the country? What do you want to see from state leaders, federal government? Join in. Your thoughts, your questions about COVID-19 at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Osterholm, what happens when more of the low-risk people do start to fall ill? Although you're saying young people are less at risk, they go back to work or they're, you know, you let some parts of the population reopen. How will the healthcare system handle that?
Well, again, the healthcare system is going to be impacted by those people who get infected who are at higher risk of having a serious illness. That right now are older individuals, particularly over age 55. It's people with underlying health problems, cardiovascular disease. We know hypertension is an example of that. And we also know that diabetes and obesity, which are often linked together, are risk factors. Now, that does provide a real challenge because right now up to 45% of the population over age 50 are obese. And I think that's a risk factor in this country that we didn't see in China, for example, where very few people in the older age population are obese. That sets up for actually when you're infected with this virus, then going on and developing this condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, which is basically your lungs and filling up with fluids because of your own body's immune response. And so what we need to figure out is what we do to protect those kinds of people that I just mentioned who have these what we call comorbidities or these other conditions. And at the same time, allowing much of the rest of society to get back into society. And I'm not saying that because it's just about dollars and cents. There are too many people who have made the false dichotomy that this is about saving lives or making money. Absolutely not true. We have so many essential services in our lives today that if we don't have them, we also have very serious challenges with health and safety. We're talking about our food supply. We're talking about fire and police. We're talking about, have you seen anybody who's ever been able to do remote work and do garbage pickup? I can go through a laundry list of areas that are really critical, and we need to talk about how we continue to function in those areas. We can't do the kind of shutdown they did in Wuhan, China, where people didn't leave their homes for 14 to 18 weeks, particularly if we're now talking about the possibility of 14 to 18 months. So that's the discussion we need to have, and it's just not happening in a way that we can have. This shouldn't be an issue about partisan politics. It shouldn't be an issue about urban, rural. This virus is going to affect all 50 states. It's going to even hit the rural areas, just like seasonal influenza does every year. It'll do the same. So we've all got to come together to figure out how we're going to push through a plan that does say this is what we're going to do to stay open. This is what we're going to do to shut down. This is what we're going to do to make sure we don't overwhelm our healthcare systems. This is what we're going to do to protect our healthcare workers who are on the front lines from catching this infection, too.
Talking with University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm with us. We're getting his perspective on how the country can best address the coronavirus pandemic. And we want to hear from you this hour. What do you want to know about how this virus works, how it spreads? Did you go to the polls on Tuesday despite the governor's stay-at-home order? How did you protect yourself? And do you worry about how this will impact Wisconsin's infection rates? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Michael Osterholm here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with an infectious disease epidemiologist about the coronavirus. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And across the country, public health officials are battling this pandemic. New York, the hardest hit state in America, reported its highest number of virus-related deaths in a single day yesterday. Have you followed through on the safer at home order? What puzzles you about social distancing and what puzzles you about flattening the curve? Join in. We're with Dr. Michael Osterholm this hour. He directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and he stays with us. Let's take another call. Now Leah is here from Madison. Hi, Leah.
Hi there.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is sort of echoing what Michael Osterholm has said, which is that, one, the government has not been honest with people about what flattening the curve means, which is that once we flatten it, we need to remain in a holding pattern to not restart the epidemic again, which is not realistic to, you know, be in our houses for 18 months. And I just wanted to speak to what they're doing on Easter Island, which is that the two families that are infected on the island, everyone is rallying around them, bringing them food, supplying them with everything they need. And a similar approach could be taken here, where the society rallies around the people that are most vulnerable, who remain in quarantine until a vaccine is available. But everyone else needs to go back to work and develop that herd immunity and get sick and get well and have that immunity.
Leah, thanks for the call. Dr. Osterholm, it sounds like Leah's really pulling for a grassroots effort to help pull along people who do need to quarantine, who cannot go back into daily life.
Yes, and I think her comments really are very perceptive in the fact that this is a complicated issue. It's not just straightforward of do this or don't do that. I'll just say right now, in areas of the United States where we have really active virus transmission going on, we still have people who ignore the idea that they shouldn't be in large groups, in congregate meetings, et cetera. And they actually feel resentful that the government is telling them what to do or not to do. And I understand that that's, you know, we all have our individual rights. But at the same time, if you get infected, you get seriously ill, you go into a hospital, you not only affect yourself, but you threaten all the people that you have now exposed before you knew you were ill, because we know that people may be most infectious in the first 2 days before they even get sick. You expose healthcare workers who are putting their life on the line to try to save you, who today we are seeing the number of cases in healthcare workers mount by the hundreds as a result of being exposed at work. So in a sense, it's personal responsibility beyond just the fact that somebody's telling you what to do or not to do to protect yourself. It's more than that. But what we have to do is craft the message so that we know when we need to do what we need to do. And what I mean by that is that this will continue to go through our society in waves. Some areas will be hit before others, and not at all at the same time. And what we need to be able to measure is say, okay, now the virus transmission is increasing again. It looks like it's going to be quite quick in terms of its acceleration. Now is the time to put the pedal to the metal and recommend to people to distance themselves from others, which is the only tool we really have, the only tool we have. And then when we have evidence that those cases appear to be decreasing, then we can let off on the accelerator again. And somehow what we've got to do is find that kind of steady state of responding to the virus, backing off, responding to the virus, backing off, and getting us to the point of a vaccine. And think of what the caller just said, you know, making sure that we're trying to protect most of all those people who are at high risk of having this disease outcome. Now, one of the things that happens is more and more people in the younger age population in particular are exposed. They get infected. They have a mild illness. We have every reason to believe at this point that they will be protected for some time to come in terms of getting reinfected, and they don't transmit to anyone else. So these are the kind of people that can go right into the middle of society and not worry about being infected again. And also, people around them don't have to worry if they're going to transmit the virus. So, you know, we avoid going to see grandpa and grandma because we don't want to give them the virus. But now that we know that, you know, we're immune from being infected again, I can go and be the key conduit to them with the rest of the world out there. And that's what we need to try to figure out in the most practical way how to do that.
Leah, thank you for the call. We're talking with Dr. Michael Osterholm, who directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Osterholm, as you've heard, Wisconsin held in-person voting Tuesday. How do you expect to see this affect Wisconsin's numbers of coronavirus cases in the coming days?
Well, we do know that for a fact, we do have challenges with groups getting together and transmitting the virus to others. There have been multiple examples of that happening. In fact, there is an article today in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Weekly Report called the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report of a cluster in a family with two family events were held in Chicago, and 16 cases occurred as a result of transmission in just these very limited kind of family gatherings. And so that, you may say, if you're a group of 18-year-olds, is not going to be a big challenge because most of you are going to be just fine after a couple of days, and maybe you feel like you have the flu, you're going to be okay. But if you're around someone who is much more likely to have a serious health outcome with it, that's a real challenge. And again, I want to remind people, and you know, this is not just about numerators, denominators, meaning the total number of people infected over the, and then the people who actually get clinically ill. This is about real people. These are our ones we love, our, you know, our parents, grandparents, our friends, our colleagues. And these are going to be more than just numbers to us as time goes on. But for the meantime, you know, yes, we'll hear about a couple of cases in younger people who do poorly, may even die, but overall the risk is much, much lower there. So I think you're going to see more of the younger population get infected and begin to develop that kind of immunity where they can be in our communities and actually they do just fine.
Let's bring in Aaron now in Oshkosh. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The reason for my call is pretty simple, listening to the previous show and this one. I think one thing is getting overlooked or not repeated enough, the risk assessment. I went out to vote in person last week down at the city hall. They did an amazing job. I voted ahead of time. Everything was sterile. I had my PPE. I've had to make a couple of trips out into the world over the past month. I see people grabbing Twinkies. And so if they're not concerned about risking their health and their well-being for some Twinkies, but yet they're having all this discussion over, oh, you put my life in jeopardy by having me vote, there's a disparaging difference between the two, and I think that more people need to be really aware of the risks and choices that they are making.
This comes down to individual choices, Dr. Osterholm.
Yeah, and I think this is a very good point, and just to follow up on the previous comment that I made, is that when you get infected and you then potentially transmit to others 2 days before you actually get clinically ill and you can't even separate yourself from the rest of the public knowing that you're transmitting, this is an important point, particularly if you need hospitalization and you put now healthcare workers at risk. You know, you do have a responsibility not just to yourself but to those around you. And I think that's why we want to emphasize both the fact that we're trying to make recommendations that will help protect your health, realizing that many of the people will only have mild illness. I want to acknowledge that up front. But at the same time, what they're doing is potentially exposing those who may die from this, which is a pretty kind of significant event, is that they have to understand that. So what we're asking people to do is be responsible. Now, I think one of the things that was brought up here about voting, is a really very important civil duty. We should do that. And what we need to do right now is be as creative as we can between now and the elections to find a way to make sure that the elections are held that are robust, they're fair, that everyone has an opportunity to participate, but does, in fact, minimize the potential contact that they have with others. I will tell you right now that there's no question in my mind that we will be seeing virus activity in the fall. It will happen. And so from that perspective, we also have to be mindful that we're preparing now for that. Don't just respond to what's happening right now in New York or in Chicago or Detroit or anywhere else. Think about next fall. How are we going to hold voting? And what are we going to do to make sure that it is as safe as possible? And so I applaud your caller who did his civil duty, who it sounded like he took every responsible step to protect himself and to protect others. And that's what we need to keep having more and more of a discussion about.
What will these ripple effects look like as the virus ebbs and flows?
Well, I think part of it is the fact that, you know, people are having to adjust to what I call the new normal. There will be no normal again. We won't go back to what it once was. And I think that what we have to help people realize that over the course of the next 18 months or more, this is going to come and go. What we're having happen right now is not going to be something that just is a distant memory soon. For some of us who have been involved with this, our group's actually been working on this since December. You know, it seems like a lifetime ago when we first started getting involved with this. For many people listening here today, their first real awareness of this was a month ago or less. And now, and they must think, you know, oh my, this whole world is doing nothing but a COVID world. The cows have been turned topsy-turvy. Well, just know that they've got many more months of that topsy-turvy situation. And so what we have to do is adjust to that and just say, you know, it's not going to be normal in a sense like it was before for some time to come. What we have to do is find the best place that we can do to get through this. We will get through this. We're going to be, on the other end of it one day. Yeah, we're going to lose some people in the process. We're going to understand the economic pain that this has caused, which will be substantial.
And we have to pause right there with Dr. Michael Osterholm as our guide as we look at COVID-19. We'll continue this conversation with him after a news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Quick signpost here. WPR has added additional newscasts each weekday, and we have a hive of pandemic-related articles and data and analysis. That's at WPR.org/COVID for you to check out. Today marks 100 days since the World Health Organization was notified of the coronavirus outbreak. That's from the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who made an impassioned plea for global solidarity yesterday, warning that politicizing the coronavirus pandemic was playing with fire.
My short message is, please quarantine politicizing COVID. The unity of your country will be very important to defeat this dangerous virus.
We have epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, who is our guide this hour. He leads the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Let's take another call now. Johnny is with us, and Johnny is a trucker driving through Wisconsin. Hi there.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you all for being on the air and getting the information out there. I'm a truck driver, and as I'm going across the country, I'm noticing there are a lot of people on the road, and I don't know how many of those are actually essential. And my concern is if people don't take serious to stay at home to slow the curve on the spread of this virus, then it's just going to prolong that even further.
Johnny, are you behind the wheel most days? Do you see any types of let-ups in any states? Or are you seeing consistently through your routes that there is a lot of traffic on the roads?
I'm seeing consistently all across the country there's still a lot of traffic on the road.
Dr. Osterholm, what do you make of that people are moving about and they're not staying in place at home?
Well, first of all, thank you for the job you do, Johnny, in terms of one of those essential workers, because obviously transportation and moving critical supplies, food, things like that are really important. So we appreciate that. I think the message here really is one of how do we stop the increasing number of cases that occur and then something we call flatten that curve. And it really is about just not having contact with other humans. Now, I think I'm an example of that in the sense that, I do leave my place. I get in my car. I drive to a location where there's not any other people, and I get out and walk around. And that's my way of coping with, being basically claustrophobically locked up in a location. I surely work remotely with all of my team and do things like that. So when there may be traffic that's out there that is actually appropriate and needed, and it's not putting people at risk, it's when those people then are driving somewhere and all get together. And as Johnny said, that's, when they're moving like that, going somewhere to get together, that's the problem. And we're not asking people to do this forever. What we're asking them is when we have evidence that the virus is increasing in their community, this is the time to distance themselves. What we need to do in public health and in conjunction with our political leaders across the board is understand in our communities, when is that happening? When do we have to ask people to row extra hard? and know that right now we're about to see this ever-increasing number of cases, and we want to dampen that. And keep doing that kind of on and off the accelerator, foot on the brake, foot on the accelerator, to get us through the 18 months until we have at that time, hopefully, a vaccine. And so we can't be in all lockdown. It's just not going to work for a lot of reasons, including the fact that we do have so many critical products and services we need. We need our medicines. We need our food, et cetera. And we also, at the same time, need to make sure that we don't add more cases to the seriously ill and, unfortunately, patients who die. So what we need to do is have this kind of discussion. What is the right account, a movement? How do we do it? And how do we all come together to support it?
Johnny, thank you for calling in. Be safe. Tom from Chippewa County called in to ask if there is a pneumonia vaccine, and if so, could that help with the pandemic?
Well, actually, that's a great question because, in fact, one of the things that happens with the COVID-19 virus is that they do develop a type of pneumonia picture that can lead to some of the very serious illnesses and even deaths. Unfortunately, the vaccine that he's talking about, while very important in terms of preventing that type of disease from a bacteria that causes that, it doesn't have any benefit in terms of the prevention of COVID-19. So I'd still recommend getting that vaccine because people are still dying from that type of infection, but it won't have any impact on this disease here.
We've also seen the FDA recently grant approval for emergency, you know, two drugs for COVID, one being the chloroquine, the other being the hydroxychloroquine. What do we know about the effectiveness of these prescriptions, these drugs?
Well, we know very little, and that is a real challenge because anecdotally people will say, aha, it worked in this case or it did this, and we have several such public statements by individuals. We have to also look at this from the standpoint not just what good does it do, but what harm does it do, because there are safety issues with these drugs. And anytime you have a drug you're taking, we're always weighing the benefits and the risks. Now, clearly saving someone's life with a drug who has COVID-19 is a big, big, big benefit. So we surely want to accentuate that and make that be the prime thing that's driving us. But at the same time, this negative side is there, and we have to be mindful of it until we figure out, is there really a benefit? Is that benefit real? And I have been involved with far too many situations where someone absolutely claims to have the cure. And then when it's actually put into well-designed studies where neither the researcher or the patient knows who got the drug or who got a placebo, something that's not at all active, and then you look to see how the two outcomes play out. And we've seen time and time again these miracle drugs that actually end up having no benefit whatsoever. And so at this point, these drugs are under study. These studies are going very rapidly, and we should have answers within days. But in the meantime, I would be very cautious about this. It's one that, you know, is could be very helpful if it's real. I have my doubts and my suspicions that, you know, what happened with some of the people who report these magic cures with this drug, we're going to get better anyway. And what we need to do is actually study that. So, again, stay tuned. I think we'll have data within weeks that will give us a better sense of what this drug does or doesn't do.
Talking with Dr. Michael Osterholm, an epidemiologist, we're looking at the course of the COVID-19 pandemic with you, along with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Dean now, who is joining us from Madison this morning. Hi, Dean.
Hi, how are you? My question is, I'd like you to comment on why is this virus different? The virulence rate, the death rate is 1 to 4%. Why are we going through all these measures for isolation when this wasn't done with SARS and H1N1 and swine flu and bird flu? Why is this different? The death rate's the same. The total amount of deaths so far are relatively the same. Why is this so different that all of a sudden now it's become a let's shut down the, you know, our economy and things like that?
Well, thank you. First of all, let me just correct some of the things you said that accurate assessments were the situation. First of all, just take SARS and MERS, the two other coronaviruses that we've worried about. And in fact, SARS, which did emerge in 2006 from China, was a disease that caused about 9,000 cases and 900 deaths around the world. We've very quickly learned that with SARS, you're not infectious really until almost the fifth or sixth day of your infection. And at that point, we can identify you as an ill patient before then, get you in isolation in a hospital, and so that you don't transmit the virus to anyone else. And that's why we were able to shut it down in a few months, that entire episode. We were able to get rid of the animal reservoir in the markets of the Guangdong province, a thing called civet cats or palm civets that basically were the primary reservoir, the source of the virus to humans. So that one was a very big deal. We did the same with MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, the coronavirus there, that again had the same principles as SARS. You're not infectious till much later in your illness. We have had some outbreaks that have occurred that did cause entire shutdowns. That was an individual who was in the Middle East, exposed to a camp, which is Seoul, Korea, exposed someone else in a hospital who that then person went to a second hospital and transmitted to more than 80 people in the emergency room one day, a number of deaths, and that was a shutdown, lockdown there. But again, we could control it easily because we understood that someone wasn't infectious till later in their illness, and once you recognize that, you can stop it. So let's take a step back on this one. This is not like seasonal flu. I have spent my whole career working on seasonal flu. About 0.1% of the people who get seasonal flu die from it. This one has a much higher case fatality rate, and it's transmitted as easily, if not more so, than flu. Let me just, you know, people all talked about how many cases might you expect, what might you see, using all this modeling. And modeling is a statistical approach to understanding the spread of virus in communities that has a lot of what I call black box elements to it. And if you believe we're overestimating the number of deaths, you can come up with all the reasons why. If you believe we're underestimating, you can come up with all the reasons why. But let me just say that the models that have been done so far are all based on very specific conditions. For example, the one we often hear about from the University of Washington is a model that looks at the cases just for the next 4 months and assumes that we're in the United States in a Wuhan, China-like lockdown, which we're not. So those numbers are unrealistically very low. Other models from Imperial College in London and the Harvard School of Public Health, et cetera, estimate that there may be as many as 1 to 2 million deaths. Let me just step back because, you know, I'm from the rural Midwest here. What sells on Main Street? What can you go down to the local cafe and get people to understand? And let me just share just this following scenario and it'll give you some impact.
Really quickly, because we're running out of time into the break. Just a few seconds.
I'll come back to it. I can come back. We'll come back afterwards, okay?
We're talking with epidemiologist Michael Osterholm here about the pandemic. There's room for you in this conversation as we look at all of the aspects of it. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us with Dr. Osterholm right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Epidemiology is the study of health in entire communities. And right now, epidemiologists are the people who track down the causes of the pandemic and they study how it spreads and how to control it. We have University of Minnesota professor and epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, who stays with us. Dr. Osterholm, we have to pause right there as you're trying to paint a picture with a scenario. Go ahead.
Well, just assume that there's 320 million Americans, which are out, and if half of them get infected over the course of the next 16 to 18 months, which is what a normal influenza pandemic might look like, and we think this coronavirus is going to do the same thing. If half of those people get infected, that's 160 million people. And you can argue that's too high, too low, but surely in our business is one that we think is a reasonable number at the low end. Look at those 160 million, about 80% of them, based on what we've seen so far in China, Europe, and the United States, will have mild to moderate illness, not at all requiring health care, not going into the hospital. Of the remaining 20%, about half of those will seek medical care, but not have to be hospitalized. About 10% will be hospitalized out of that total. And of that 10%, 5% will actually require critical care medicine or intensive care care. And 1% will die. Well, that 1% of 160 million is 1.6 million people. Right now, COVID-19 is the number one cause of death in the United States by day. Right now, it is the number one. by far. And the 1.6 million deaths, should they occur like this over the course of the next 18 months, will completely choke many of our healthcare systems throughout the country. We're seeing that now in the hotspots. So for the previous caller's comments, they just weren't realistic. This is going to be a serious challenge. And it is very different than influenza. It's very different than what we've seen with any of the other kind of viruses that he talked about.
Let's bring in Mark now, joining us from Kimberly with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hi. There are two good items of a British program called Science in Action. And one is about a paper-based test, very inexpensive, less than a pound sterling, $1.23. And it develops right on site in about 45 minutes. And it simulates or does what you do in a lab with about six steps on this paper. It's put together with what they call a wax printer. It sounds like some kind of photocopier or that. And it's used for wastewater-based epidemiology where, say, you got a county that or a village, city that isn't showing cases or just a few, and you can track the infection down through the pipe network of the sewage system and maybe pin it down to a neighborhood or part of the city and then do screening. And it can be used directly, too, they say, and that's amazing, if that's true, to find asymptomatic cases with this, basically, a urine test on paper.
Yeah, Mark, let's let Dr. Osterholm jump in here. Go ahead.
Thank you. And what Mark's talking about is a type of surveillance system for the virus itself that's in our sewer systems because there's some evidence it's excreted from the stool, although I must add that we find now that's actually not very common. It's quite rare that that happens. But we can surely pick up some of the genetic material, the debris of the virus infection in the stool. We actually have probably, I think, much better ways to do that. The asymptomatic cases, which you appropriately say would be picked up from detecting something in the environment, whereas we wouldn't see these people otherwise. But if you look at the proportion of asymptomatic cases to clinical cases, if we're looking for influenza-like illness in neighborhoods, we actually have the ability to pick that up. And where those cases are at are also where there's asymptomatic infection. So I think, you know, you're thinking about it the right way in terms of how do we want to best detect these. But I think the kinds of methods we have today to look just routinely for influenza-like illness occurrence at our local doctor's office give us a really quite good read on where it's at by community, by county, et cetera.
Mark, thank you. Let's bring in Sadie now, joining us from Janesville. Hi, Sadie. Good morning.
Good morning. Just had a question. We're a farming community, and a bunch of us are out here milking our cows every day, out with our goats, out with our chickens. We're outside. What does fresh air do to this actual virus? We've been getting, you know, we're cooped up in our houses, which at this time of the year are very stale. If we can get outside, does that have anything at all to do about getting fresh air down into our lungs and help with this virus?
Yeah, thank you. Actually, fresh air in and of itself doesn't help at all with you, actually, if you're infected with the virus. Where it helps is that the more air that passes by you that is not laden with someone else having breathed in it, meaning rebreathing air that someone else just exhaled out, is what will really reduce the transmission of this virus. So just being in non-crowded areas with air movement around you really reduces the likelihood you're going to come in contact with it. And so that's the benefit of it. But I think the second one that you really hit upon is not so much about the virus itself, but it's about the psychology of what's happening right now. And just being able to be out, to be able to feel that you're not just, quote-unquote, cooped up inside your place, is really a very, very important psychological issue. And when you're not exposing anyone else because you're not in crowded spaces, but you're out walking around, those are the kind of rewards that we have to give ourselves today. And I think in that regard, that's a very healthy and good thing to do.
Sadie, take care on the farm. Let's go to Linda now in Eau Claire. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Here's my question. Can epidemiologic research investigate whether political ideology has affected the incidence of COVID-19 infection? We're in a rabid partisanship environment starting from the White House, and just curious about that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Linda.
Well, yeah, let me just say, from that perspective, I've served roles in the last five presidential administrations, including in this administration. I served as a science, citizen science envoy for the State Department last year while at the University of Minnesota. I worked for two Democratic governors, two Republican governors, and one independent governor here in Minnesota as state epidemiologist at the State Health Department. So, you know, I've always seen myself as just a private in the public health army without partisan issues. You know, my job is to just try to protect the public's health. Having said that, let me just be clear that public policy makes all the difference in the world, how we respond to things. And I think in this country, we were very slow to respond to this. We at our center declared on January 20th that this was going to be a worldwide pandemic, laid out the reasons why, went through all of the steps to help people understand where it would show up around the world. By the end of January, and actually warned some of the manufacturers of the protective equipment healthcare workers' needs that this was happening. We met with senior leadership at 3M on January 20th and told them what our findings were on January 21st. They went full bore producing these respirators, these N95s, 24/7 with every machine going. So, you know, our federal government didn't get involved with securing these N95 respirators until early March. So there have been decisions like that. I think what's important right now is we move forward and say, where do we need to go? What do we need to do? And we need a plan. We do not have a national plan yet to see how we're going to get through the next 18 months or more. And that's going to be critical for the public. It's going to be critical for business. It's critical for the rest of the world to see what we do to get through it. And if that's ideology that gets in there in the way of getting those plans done, whatever, we got to get the plans done. So, yes. Policy is just that. It's bringing people together with different ideas, different principles, different values. But in this case, we're fighting one virus, and we all have to get together on that.
Dr. Osterholm, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and he wrote a recent opinion piece in the Washington Post explaining why a national lockdown is not the answer. Just ahead, it is on point why coronavirus is hitting communities of color hardest. The coronavirus pandemic is hitting some communities harder than others, and we discuss the disproportionate toll it's taking on African Americans. That's on point coming up next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.